Okay, so hi everyone and welcome to The Thing About Cotton, a podcast brought to you by the International Cotton Association. We are your hosts, Camille Cluzel and Imar McDonough, members of the ICA's Women in Cotton Committee. In this podcast, we've explored nearly every step of the cotton journey, from farmers to merchants, to the markets that set cotton prices. But today we're diving into something a bit less transactional and arguably more transformational. Because the thing about cotton is, it's not just a crop or a commodity. It's a global public good, one that supports over 100 million livelihoods and threads through some of the world's most vulnerable communities. And at the heart of many of those communities, women. Today, we're thrilled to be joined by Alison Ward, CEO of Cotton Connects, an organization doing some of the most meaningful groundwork in cotton sustainability today. Cotton Connect is a bridge builder, linking farm to brand, field to future, and crucially, making sure women are no longer an afterthought in that journey. We'll talk about their Women in Cotton program, how women are leading climate adaptation on their farms, and why systemic change starts with recognizing who's really doing the work in our supply chains.
Alison Ward has over 30 years of international experience in sustainability and corporate affairs. Alison is the CEO of Cotton Connect, where she leads a team of over 140 employees, impacting the lives of over 800,000 cotton farmers in India, China, Pakistan, Turkey, Egypt, and Bangladesh. Under Alison's leadership and organization, Cotton Connect drives supply chain transparency, connecting sustainable fibers from farm to store. It focuses on the rights and skills of women in supply chains through pioneering gender programs and continues to develop innovations at a farm level. Alison leads cotton strategies and programs for global brands and retailers. Previously, Alison worked with Mondelez International and Kraft Foods and was the global head of corporate responsibility at Cadbury. With a mission to drive scalable change, Alison served as a member of the Sustainable Cotton Steering Committee for Textile Exchange. She also sat on the Sustainability Advisory Committee for the London Olympic Games and has been a coach and mentor to commercial teams at WWF and the Ethical Trade Initiative. Alison is also a Life Fellow of the RSA, Royal Society of Arts, Manufacturers and Commerce. Alison, welcome to the pod today. And before we get into the interview, I am fascinated to know why you went from food and chocolate in particular to cotton.
So hello and good morning and afternoon to all your listeners. So yes, what a journey from the world of chocolate and then finding cotton. I think when I left the chocolate sector, there was a lot happening. Every brand and retailer had their own sustainability commitment. There was a lot of work, there was a lot of money invested. Cotton, back in 2013 when I joined, really there wasn't a huge investment in cotton sustainability, and I think the sector was really at the start of its journey. And for me, that was quite attractive to really think about, what does the cotton sector need next? There'd been quite a lot of work, and you might remember the Greenpeace campaign about factories where the colour of the river changed depending on what being dyed in the factory. So there'd been a lot of work in factories and a lot of work on that, the environmental impacts from factories, but very little really looking at the farmers and that supply chain at the beginning of that supply chain. So really, I could see that the cotton sector really needed more effective change. And I felt that the cocoa sector really was really well on its way in terms of its commitments.
And before we go into more about Cotton Connect particularly, I'm interested in the difference in the supply chain complexity. So, because we all believe that cotton has one of the most, or the most complex supply chain. Is that what you found going from cocoa over to cotton?
So cocoa is a tree crop. So unlike our cotton farmers who have a choice every year to grow cotton, obviously the farmers we work with, particularly in West Africa, they got trees that were perhaps over 30 years old. But I found some real similarities when I joined. So we were finding an aging population in cocoa. And I think if you go in any rural cotton farm in the countries we work in, you will find that it tends to be the older generation that are there. Youth have gone to the cities to work in, you know, exciting IT jobs. In terms of sort of lack of agronomic awareness. That's quite similar in terms of, obviously, there's a lot of scientific knowledge and we work with some amazing agronomists, but how does that information translate into a farmer when they're making decisions? There's also, you know, the challenge of women that we're going to be talking about. And as I left the work at Mondelez through Cocoa Life, we had had this amazing program where we had a set of women that were women trainers. So typically in cocoa, it was the cocoa board that was doing the training. But obviously, if you're a woman in a rural community in Ghana, you are unlikely to attend a training by a man from outside of the village, and it probably wasn't culturally appropriate for you to do so. So there were some really inspiring women that had started women's agronomic training, where they, it was a train the trainer model, and they were really educating other women. And then when I came to Cotton Connect and came into the cotton sector, I went to my first village in India, in Gujarat, in northwest India. And there were no women in the meeting, like zero. Like there were just men in this village meeting. And I was like, I said to my team, where are the women? And you could see it, sort of this quick, rapid Hindi, Gujarati questions. Where are the women? Find the women. Lots of women. And I think that was really the beginning of my journey, that I'd seen the power of talking and educating and empowering women through our work in cocoa in Ghana, and then really seeing the lack of women having any kind of agronomic training in cotton at that point. So this was 2013-14, before we really all began to think about women as a key stakeholder in training. So really, that there were quite a lot of similarities. And I think that sort of idea that you can really give farmers a little bit of information, you can help them understand their crop better, and they really saw and really have great gains in terms of their agronomic understanding, but also the financial impact as well for their farm and their community.
Yeah, well, we're certainly hearing that.
Yeah, there's so much to unpack in all of that. It's so interesting, and we can't wait to dive deeper into it. But first, for listeners less familiar with Cotton Connect, maybe how would you describe its place in the entire cotton value chain? You talk a lot about the farmers here, but is that only where it sits, or do you also work at the other end of the value chain with brands and retailers?
Yeah, so Cotton Connect, we work right back at the farm level, so these very rural communities, and these can be very small holder farms, so perhaps 1.5 hectares, so really small, that it's generally a family farm, and that it will be multi-crop, so there'll be cotton, but there'll be other crops and maybe some cattle. What's really important for me, and when I came in from the cocoa supply chain, was we know we can have an impact agronomically. But what's really important is to connect that cotton into a supply chain. So it's not a philanthropic effort at one end of the supply chain. We're really having traceability and transparency that connects that more sustainable cotton into a garment. And then back in 2013, when we started our journey, in particular with Primark, we set out to do what everyone said was impossible, which was have that traceability from farmer into garment. And now, if you fast forward sort of almost 12 years later, we can look at a garment and tell you where the sustainable cotton in that garment has come from, which farm and even which farmer.
It's still very niche, though, in terms of the entire global value chain. It's still a very niche part of the industry where we are able to do that. But you're right, it's possible.
If we look at what's happening in legislation in Europe and elsewhere and into the US, you have to have traceability and transparency now. That isn't an option. So I think we're really seeing that dynamic shift.
Mm-hmm. Alison, how does Cotton Connect get its funding? I know that you've had a shareholder change a little while ago. Can you just explain what the structure of the association is like and how are decisions made around investment?
Yes, so we're funded by brands and retailers, so very much around funds for services. So we will be paid for farmer training, or we have a traceability platform, TraceBell, so we'll be paid for services. We then have a small board, so our governance is quite light. I think, as you all know from other experiences, you can end up with very large boards, so we have Lorraine Pepper on our board, who is the ex-executive director of Textile Exchange. We have a finance director who's come out of the Lauders Foundation, myself, and then we're just about to appoint a new non-executive director who's based in India. So again, reflecting the power of our organisation in the Indian subcontinent.
Yeah, it's interesting to see the light touch at the top. It's because sometimes it can become quite executive heavy as well. And so we were initially drawn to Cotton Connect, obviously because of the Women in Cotton program. Can you talk to us a bit about the Women in Cotton program? And obviously it was formed based on what you've just discussed and the need to have more women involved. But how has it evolved? And can you give us a little bit of how the impact of that program has helped?
Yes, absolutely. So it really began with understanding how to best interact with women at a community level, and very much about how and when do we train women. So women have lots of tasks at a farm level in rural communities in India or Pakistan. So quite often we might need to train in the early evening or fit around their other activities that they're doing in the household. So really thinking about the timing, thinking about who's doing the training, so making sure it's somebody who's appropriate in the village. So our model is that we work with a local partner, so they will have the local language, they will understand the local customs. It's also been really important that we get the buy-in from the men, so from the village elders, and really look at how that interaction to village works. So we make sure that the women are able to attend the training, it's seen as acceptable. Quite often we might start with something around health and nutrition as a bit of a Trojan horse. So it's very acceptable for women to go and learn about health and nutrition before they learn more about perhaps human rights or some more sensitive topics. So really earning that trust in the community, and then really understanding the agronomy from there forward. In terms of our impacts, we really see this tied into our overall impacts as an organisation. And we really see that when the women are involved, we see overall the farm is seeing reductions in pesticide and chemical use. And this also increases profit. So we can see our latest impact report shows profits of up by over 26%. And that's an increase of yield and a reduction in input. So really training the women we've seen as having an enormous financial impact. And that's just the financial metrics. There's also the huge social impacts. More recently, we've introduced the Climate Change Ambassador Program. And there, women have learned more about the impact of climate change. But when I visited some women in India recently, they were saying about how proud they were to have this information and how their status had improved in the village. So for me, whilst we can talk about the impact on the cotton crop, there's also this other social impact that is not just about the women today, but also about their daughters and their sons, who see the women being more confident and having a better interaction and a better status in the village.
And Alison, before we dive more into specific action, I think it's interesting, you mentioned something at the very beginning when you were talking about younger generation moving to the cities with an aging population in the farm. There's also a comment in your report that obviously states the same thing is true with women versus men, with men migrating more to cities for better livelihoods, whereas women are staying behind. Can you talk a little bit about the traditional barriers that you've witnessed at the early stage of your career in cotton, even when it comes to land ownership for women, etc.? Those are really concrete issues and barriers that women have to face that make all the work that you do very,
yes, I
very
think the
important.
The first barrier is that women haven't been seen as farmers, even though if you look at the tasks the women do, so they will prepare the land, they will sow the seed, the cotton seed, they will then weed, they will then take care of the cotton plant as it grows, they may prune it a little bit, they then pick the cotton, they then segregate the cotton. But if I talk to, and I had a very heated debate with one of my team in Pakistan, I was going, yeah, but they're farmers. No, they're not farmers, Alison. Yes, but they do all this work. But they're not seen as farmers because they don't own the land. And I think that's probably the biggest barrier, the status in the village and land ownership really driving whether women are called farmers or not. And for me, they are, because they do all this work, but technically they don't own the land. So technically they're not the farmer. And I think for me...
So they're perceived as farm support and help.
Yes, yes. But in fact, they do all the work. And when we have looked in the past, then as you can imagine, the financial transaction happens by the men. So the women do all of the work, and a lot of the value add in the crop. And I don't know if you've got into sort of rural smallholder cotton. The first time you pick the cotton, it's the longest staple length. So one of the things we do is encourage the women to separate out that first cotton picking from the second and third picking. So in India, Pakistan, there's still was a lot of... In a lot of other countries, there's just the machine just goes through once. This is manual picking that maybe happens, you know, three or even four times. By the time you get to the fourth time of picking, the staple length is shorter, and then obviously you've got more contamination in it, so more leaves, etc. We also teach women and men actually about removing contamination and trash from the cotton, because obviously then they get higher, it's a higher quality when they're selling it to the gym. So all of that is adding value. But when it actually comes to the trading, it's so often the men that are trading, and it's so often the men that are taking the money. So despite all the work we do, there's still a lot for us to do in terms of this sort of economic balance.
But land ownership is really critical to that, isn't it? And there are some changes in certain parts of India around women being co-owners of the land with their husbands. So at least if something were to happen, they still have the ownership of the land to depend on. Are you seeing that change in other countries as well?
I think in particular in India, and it is driven by the government. So the government do have schemes to encourage more joint land ownership. So I do have to say I am joined by Monty, the magician.
Oh, wonderful.
So you can hear some little dog-type noises on the podcast. That is Monty, the magician.
He must have something to tell us, Alison.
Yes, very bright dog. It's time, I think. back to land ownership. I mean, I think it's India that's really progressing, and the government. And we're fortunate enough to work with the Self-Employed Women's Association, which is a trade association, a trade union association for women. And they're really at the forefront of driving women's rights and really looking at how sort of broader landscape moves can really impact on women. And that includes the role of government, the role of people like ourselves, and the role of the brands that they work with as well.
Mm-hmm. I just wanted to ask a question around that climate change. And I know that you've recently done a report on the impact on women of climate change, that women have been disproportionately affected by climate change. And there was a really beautiful quote from a female cotton farmer in Gujarat. And it was that for years, we viewed climate change as a divine punishment rather than a scientifically explainable phenomenon, unaware that we were contributing to the changes around us. That's a very profound and knowledgeable quote, Alison. So can you tell us a little bit about that report and what its findings were?
Yes. So the quote's from Kumida Ben Tanvi, who is one of our climate change ambassadors in Gujarat in India. And I was fortunate to meet, I've been and visited her farm and met her family. And then we did a round table discussion. So the women from the village came into Ahmedabad, the nearest biggest city, and then met some local experts, and we had a roundtable discussion about the impacts of climate change. Even that meeting was the first time that the women had left their village area and come into that major city, Ahmedabad. So, and they were allowed to come on as a group of women without their husbands. So for me, you know, an amazing step that they had the confidence to come, and they had the confidence to come and talk to me as well. And I think if we look at the impacts that we're seeing, really extreme heat in terms of what's going on in India. And I was in India last week, and it's already getting really hot. So I don't know if your degree C or Fahrenheit, so we're regularly seeing temperatures over 50 degrees C, which is 122 Fahrenheit.
Gosh.
So really, really hot. And if you think about trying to work in that, and women have lots of duties, so looking after the household, we've talked about maybe there's some livestock duties. They're getting up earlier and working later in order to avoid this extreme heat. We might be seeing that perhaps the water source is further away, and if they get money from milk, that the cattle are producing less. So we're seeing this increased burden on women in terms of work. I think the other thing that really came out of our report this time was that women are quite, their health is being affected, because you imagine this sort of heat does affect your health, but also they were quite stressed by it. And I think Kumida Ben really was explaining that they now understood what climate change was, and that actually was helpful, because before they didn't think they could control it or do anything about it, but it was making them an increased emotional burden about the future of their farm and the future for their family. So I think as we begin to look at climate change and its impacts, we also have to think about that human impact. It's not just about the crop, but about the people that are farming. We recently did some work with the European Space Agency, and we were looking at how we take sort of satellite climate data and take it into Bangladesh, how we could sort of cascade that information so it would help with flood warnings or drought warnings, probably more flood warnings in Bangladesh. And what was really interesting is that part of that was a health component. So, which is quite unusual. And obviously, the European Space Agency, it was really important to them that there was a health element as we were talking about heat. And I think we're going to see more of this, that we really need to look at the human impact on health from extreme weather conditions, whether it be flood, whether it be, you know, sort of insect attacks, and whether it be heat. So really quite a wide ranging impact on the women that we spoke to.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's impressive, that statistic in the report, to say that 4 out of 5 people displaced by the impact of climate change are women and girls.
Yeah, so we can really see this disproportionate effect on the most vulnerable in supply chains. So really something I think as a sector we need to take account for. And it was, I think it was 3 years ago now in Pakistan that we saw the devastating floods that took lives and livelihoods, where the topsoil was just completely washed away. So, I mean, we've been involved in quite a sort of unilateral programs to rebuild. But unusually, and we've never done this before, our first response was to sort of support these farmers in livelihoods. So, and we haven't had to do this before. We're a social enterprise. We're looking at business solutions and sustainability. But we provided chickens so that there was some immediate livelihoods. You know, we looked at different ways of providing sanitation and water. I mean, normally we wouldn't do this. But actually, I think as you saw in Pakistan a few years ago, it really was devastating, this sort of, you know, unforeseen flooding that took place.
And doesn't that speak to the livelihood impact that cotton can have? And you know, without it, there's nothing. You know, it really is. It's a force for good, but without it, it's devastating to farmers.
So, what does climate resilience look like on the ground?
So, I think there are no silver bullets, but I think what we can do is help farmers have better adaptation. So first of all is the information we've talked about. So farmers become aware of climate change, and we can see from our Climate Change Ambassadors program that the awareness of climate change has really become almost 100% amongst women. We also then want to give them some really simple techniques in terms of how they can improve and protect themselves in terms of extreme heat. So that might be composting, so helping them to develop composting techniques, water harvesting, planting tree shade. So one of our team in India has had a One Farmer, One Tree campaign where we encourage farmers to plant a tree. Obviously, the benefit of that comes a bit later, but that provides shade, and it also increases biodiversity as well, because it's a natural bird perch. So I was in Nagpur recently on an amazing organic farm, and it was intercropped between the orange trees. So what a fabulous farm, where there were these sort of natural bird perches through this farm, where they were making compost, they were harvesting water, they were really using all of their natural resources to really protect their farms. So some of these are quite simple techniques, and the aim is that we're not really asking farmers to have huge investments, but they really use those natural resources. And I think in India there's always been a movement of zero input agriculture. So how do we use those perhaps techniques from, you know, indigenous techniques to really think about the future of cotton farming?
Well, just on that point, you're just raising something in my mind about, you know, there's a shift towards regenerative farming now as a, you know, as a premium in the market for something that is seen to be grown well. I mean, is that tokenism to what's actually being done on the ground? Or, you know, do you think that this drive for regenerative farming, regeneratively farmed cotton, is going to be of benefit in the long term?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so haven't we seen a shift to regenerative? And I think, I mean, every conversation we have with a brand or retailer is around regenerative agriculture. For me, it is a movement that I think is really important. And if I look back for the past 10 years in our Cotton Connect business, we've been doing less bad. So it's been about less pesticide, less fertilizer. Whereas this future about a regenerative landscape is about biodiversity. It's about leaving that landscape better than we found it. And I think as we look at the impacts, we can see again already in our regenerative expert groups, we are seeing yield increase, we're seeing biodiversity increase. So we're seeing really positive impacts from that. And if I share a couple of examples, we've just done a pilot with AgriSound where they monitor the bee frequencies. So it's a radio frequency and you can pick up the bee frequency. And we have seen actually, and obviously it's a really small pilot, so we can see that there are more bees going into a regenerative farm mm-hmm. than a conventional farm, so which is fantastic, isn't it? So just by monitoring the sound waves of a bee, we can see an amazing biodiversity impact. So for me, I do think regenerative is the future for cotton farming. We started in 2021 in COVID when we put together our first regenerative code. And since then, we've been really wanting to understand what that means in a smallholder context. So it is in North America a really big movement. How does it work in rural Bangladesh? How does it work in rural India or Pakistan? And that's been really important for us. We now have about 250,000 farmers who have been trained in regenerative practices. So we're really seeing how it can be applied in those smallholder contexts. So quite an important movement for the sector, but it's important to make sure we're getting it right in terms of its on the ground impact as well.
Mm. And it also supports the resilience of farming. And, you know, sometimes farmers know their land better than anybody else coming in to tell them what to do. But this is more about integrating what's actually happening on the ground with showing them or educating them ways to improve what they're already doing, because there's no one size fits all. I mean, soil types change from region to region, temperature from region to region, water, et cetera, et cetera. So it is quite an integrated approach, isn't it? Regenerative farming is not what happens in Brazil doesn't necessarily work in Pakistan or India, for example.
I'm curious to hear about the, you know, how success is tracked in all these operations that you're conducting. And in particular, you've trained thousands of women. So how do you measure something like confidence or leadership and the progress that is actually being made on the ground beyond, well, I suppose that's one of them, yield improvements on the farms, but yeah, can you give us a bit of the impacts and the measurement?
Yeah, so a really good question. So I think we've really evolved our measurement techniques. When I first joined Cotton Connect, we had hard copy farmer field books. And I remember visiting our office in Ahmedabad and there was piles and piles of these paper documents that were slowly being eaten by paper mites. So we've actually, we've now got a digital app which is really running successfully. And it sounds really easy to put everything digitally, but actually you're gathering data in a rural community. You need to make sure there's good connections. You need to make sure that whoever's operating that system understands the information they're putting in. And what's I think really powerful about once you get online is that there are checks and balances you can make in terms of has that information been added incorrectly. We now have a farmer identification app where we're scanning photos of the farmer and we're scanning their ID. So we've got that validation. And we can also geotag their farm. So we now can measure the size of their farm. And then if we get a cotton output, we should be able to calculate if that's about right or not, depending on that season. So the technology is really giving us more sort of quicker information and checks and balances. I think, Cammy, your question about how do you measure the social impact? And for me, it is very much about when you meet women and you look and you meet their daughters and their sons and you see the impact that our work has had. And if you look at our most recent report, it was really one of the reasons we ran those focus groups across the markets to really hear their voices and amplify them. And there you can see that they are talking about the knowledge that they've gained and the confidence that they've gained through these programs. But I think we do need specific, which is why this is our third report on women in cotton and climate change, because we want to understand what's happening and hear their voices. It's no point me sitting in London deciding what's important for a group of cotton farmers in Gujarat.
Alison, can you tell us about one woman in particular whose story sticks with you even today?
Yes. So I think there was a woman I met in Bangladesh a couple of years ago called Beauty Khatun, and she was part of our women's program. And here we were teaching women to have micro businesses. She had started a vermicompost business. And she started making this great compost, and she showed me her vermicompost setup with all the different stages of vermicompost. She's now making a month in addition to her normal income, around $287 in addition.
Wow.
Yeah, I know, selling vermicompost. So they're using it on her farm and then she's selling it to her village. And of course her, you know, it's gone from her husband sort of letting her do it to now he's helping her and invested in more sort of concrete sort of planters for the compost to go through its various processes. So, I mean, it's a micro business for her, but really the impact for her and her family, that extra money each month is so, you know, such an incredible uplift for their family. So, I mean, what a fantastic woman. She showed me all her worms very pretty. And then I think the other, if I'm allowed a second,
this is
Pakistan. We did some work on gender-based violence, and we weren't sure really whether this was our role. There are specialist people who work in gender-based violence. So we educated women in India, Bangladesh and Pakistan. And as a result, in Pakistan, there was a 14-year-old who was going to be married. But because of our program, her mother talked to her husband and then she talked to the elders in the village, and they all agreed that the daughter was too young to be married at that stage.
Wow.
So for me, I know. So these lives that are changed because of access to information given in the right way, in the right context. It's not me blundering into a village, telling people what to do. It's local discussions, very respectful of local cultures and norms, that we're really beginning to shift societal expectations and really give women more status, more money in their pocket, but also really inspiring the next generation of women in cotton farms as well.
That's brilliant.
Thank you so much for sharing.
I have a question speaking to differences in regions. I was really intrigued to see China as a country that you're working in, because, you know, usually we consider a lot of the work on the ground is done particularly or predominantly in the subcontinent region. So does the program look the same in China, and what regions are you operating in?
Yes, so we're in Hebei and Shandong, so that's sort of the central region in China, and we have been working there for a number of years. The farming is quite different. I mean, it's rather than having small farms, the farmers work collectively through co-ops. they're big land parcels, so they're using tractors. It's much more mechanized. It's also the demographic is quite different, and it really is the grannies and grandpas that are left in China. Everybody else has gone to the city. So when I visited, it really is this sort of generation, the older generation that are farming. What's interesting, we've also done some work on regenerative in China. And I think wherever you go in the world, agriculture is under such stress, whether it be about soil degradation, whether it be the impacts of climate change, so that could be, you know, drought or flood. And we've really seen, you know, some real interest from the farmers and our stakeholders in China about regenerative and what that could offer in terms of the future of farming for China.
Mm. Yeah, good. And you're right, very different demographic, isn't it, in what's happening in China. I have to address the elephant in the room to some degree. You know, Cotton Connect is supported by brands and retailers, but given the current change in geopolitical issues and trade wars and tensions and, you know, pullback on DEI, et cetera, do you feel challenged? Is your group feel challenged by these changes? And, you know, how do you see those affecting your work?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I think the first thing is the uncertainty for the sector. And I think that, I mean, when I was in India last week, I was in and out of meetings, and I was like, if you blink for a moment, you've missed an update, haven't you, on the tariffs? So I think that's the hardest thing. It's just hard enough to keep up with the changes. I do think it's a challenge for us in the whole sustainability world. And one of the things that's really been important when I've been at Cotton Connect is making this of commercial value. If we're purely philanthropic, and there's nothing wrong with philanthropic dollars or in philanthropic investments, but we have to be making sure we're adding commercial value in terms of what we do. And that's really been at the heart of this. So if we think, we talked earlier about the importance of transparency and traceability for legislation, that drives business, because we're addressing their risk register at a board level. And that's where I think we have to make sure that we're relevant, and we're relevant as a business solution. I'm not saying we've got it completely correct, but this is about making sure that everyone in the supply chain, from the farmer who's seeing a yield increase to a ginner who's got more visibility of that supply chain, to a spinner who's perhaps interacting with the brand for a first time, to the brand that really understands their supply chain, perhaps they can put a carbon measurement through it, but they can also manage their risk in supply as well.
And would it be fair to say that the change in the EU legislation is more of the driver of that rather than what's happening in the EU at the moment? I mean, we all understand that the chaos that's happening in the US is an unknown. You're right, there's so much uncertainty, but the EU seems to be continuing with their Green Claims Directive and the EU Green Deal. So that would still be the focus of your work around sustainability and measuring?
Yes, absolutely. So, when we've reviewed all the legislation that's going through Europe, I think there are four key areas. One is transparency and traceability. The second is, if you're going to make a claim, you now need valid data. And I think we've seen a number of court cases, or we've had a couple in the UK where brands made a claim and then haven't been able to support it fully through data. We also know that end of life, mm-hmm. circularity, it's not a big area for us. We've been looking at traceability and circularity. Obviously, it's important, again, if you're claiming something circular, is it? And then the fourth is the human rights due diligence as well. So obviously, again, as Europe operates, there's lots of horse trading going on in Europe in terms of between the member states. We are seeing some changes in legislation, but they, I believe, are the four areas that a sector are going to really impact on us for the future. I think what's important is it's not just important in terms of legislation, but it's also about ethical business. So all of those are about ethical business. Do you know your supply chain? If you're making a claim, can you support it? What's the end of life of your product? And it doesn't matter if it's clothing, it could be anything within that we make. And then the fourth is, how do we treat people within that supply chain? For me, that's all about business ethics and the kind of businesses we want to work for and the kind of world we want. And so I think you almost sort of ladder up to quite a different agenda if you begin to look through the lens of business ethics. But again, that necessarily isn't at the top of a board agenda in the C-suite, but we know that the risk register will be.
That's great. And yeah, that leads perfectly with you talk a lot about the future here. What's your vision of the future for Cotton Connect? And, you know, if you fast forward 5 years from now, what do you hope the legacy of the work that you're doing right now will be, and what will be the challenges in 5 years?
Yes, I think we're really seeing, as we talked about, the rise of regenerative. So, I mean, we really have a vision that all of our work is regenerative and that we really understand regenerative, as Imoi, you've been talking about, in the local context. So how do we make sure it's relevant? I think that we are seeing the rise of more government and national-led ownership. So in India, we're at the Baratech conference earlier in the year, which is run by the Indian government. They have a big push on Kasturi cotton. So this is their own cotton brand. And really part of that is traceability and transparency. So I think in the next 5 years, we're really going to be seeing sovereign governments controlling more of the cotton trade and more of the sustainability claims within that. I mean, really following, we work in Egypt, really following, we've already got Egyptian cotton as this amazing brand, you know, they're really strengthening sustainability as part of that. So I think we're going to see more and more governments taking accountability for cotton quality and sustainability, which I think is a good thing. I mean, India is about to become the third largest economy, taking away the crown from Japan. So we've really got this rise of nationalism.
Nationalism.
Which I think is positive in terms of ownership. Mm-hmm. Within the cotton sector.
It's nice to hear nationalism used as a positive term rather than more of a right-wing extreme term.
Yes, exactly.
But it is an interesting perspective, isn't it, to think about 5 years out from now, because as you say, the news cycle is not even 24 hours anymore. It's probably closer to 5 or 6 hours. So this constant, you know, fear and trepidation about what's coming next, it's good to see a projection of 5 years and for the programs of regenerative farming to continue. Yes. I don't know if I'm 100% on board with the nationalism aspect of it. I don't think Australian farmers would want the government to have too much involvement they do. But it's horses for courses, right? It depends on the region. And we did hear with an interview we did recently with ICRA in Pakistan that some of the spinning mills are actually buying land so that they can secure their transparency in their supply chain too. So the different ways of meeting the same demands of knowing where your product comes from, really.
Yes, absolutely.
Before we let you go though, Alison, we like to ask all of our guests, what's the one thing about cotton that they like our listeners or audience to know in your own world and view? If there was one thing that listeners should take away with them?
Yes, I think that it's about the people behind your t-shirt. And I think so often we buy a pair of jeans or a t-shirt or some pajamas, but actually there's probably a woman who grew your cotton, and it might be Kamida Ben, or it might be Beauty Katun from Bangladesh, who are women that we work with. And actually the programs that we do have changed their lives in terms of their income and their status. And I think that's the one thing, the takeaway, is that quite often we just don't know where whether it's the food we buy or the garments we buy, where they've come from. But actually it's just taking that moment to think about that individual behind the garment.
Thank you so much, Alison.
Yeah, if we could all do that, Alison, and then if we thought more about cotton behind a garment rather than man-made fibre behind a garment.
That's true.
We've got to spin that somehow. Excuse the pun.
All right. Thank you so much, Alison.
Yeah, thank you so much for your time.
Lovely to meet you both. Thank you. What a great podcast.
That was such an interesting conversation with Alison. You know, we have spoken to Eric from ICAC previously, but this really reinforces cotton as a global public good. But the impact that they're having on the ground is quite phenomenal. I mean, just that one story about how they were able to assist a woman with her worm farm, improving her monthly income for the family. And it, and the way it's done in a very respectful way, and you know, not trampling over culture and saying it must be done this way, but really respecting what happens on the ground in villages was very refreshing. What do you think, Kim?
Yeah, and it's such a great reminder of, you know, we take so many things for granted in certain parts of the world, and the work that is being done on the farm at these levels. I mean, for me, it was so striking to be reminded that some of the barriers that women are facing are so concrete, to the extent of access to land ownership and the results and the impact that this has. But getting to know more about the Cotton Connect work that they're doing on the ground was fascinating, and especially everything that, you know, with the interest of the brands behind it, that links everything together. And I think Alison sets the stage perfectly for us to discuss a bit about the updates of the framework of the European legislation. And the best way for us to dive into this is by talking to an organization that's called Make the Label Count. So we're going to be working on that in our upcoming episode, right, Imar?
Yeah, and I think that's going to tie a lot of things together on why brands and retailers are really investing in programs like the ones that Cotton Connect are rolling out, because their impact is being reported, and they are being responsible for, you know, the life cycle of the products that they're producing. So it makes sense that they're actually understanding the impact on the ground of the fiber that they're purchasing. One of the comments that I really liked that Alison said was about the people behind the T-shirt. You know, they're women behind the T-shirt, which, mm-hmm. you know, when you put it in those terms, it really does connect the fiber to the people.
And more often again, than not, they're women buying the T-shirts as well. So,
well, it's over 95% of household purchases are done by women again. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that certainly makes sense. So I really enjoyed that conversation, and I hope it's very informative to our audience. And, you know, I think we probably have a little bit more to explore in that area as time goes by, and hopefully we don't see too much of a negative impact from the current trade war issues, or, you know, the relocation of things impacting people on the ground. You know, I like the 5-year positive outlook for, you know, continuing to have a positive impact and not doing less bad, but improving impact overall. So, yeah, we'll be watching it.
Yeah. And I just want to say a quick comment that today's episode was actually made possible by a listener suggesting and putting forward the suggestion of Cotton Connect for a future episode. So we really, truly appreciate all of your contributions and your feedback. So please keep sending emails and feedbacks. And if you want to learn more about today's episode or have other questions in general, feel free to email us at podcast@ica-ltd.org. And obviously, don't forget to like and subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or Google, and follow the Women in Cotton group on LinkedIn and Facebook to find out about our upcoming podcast episodes, events, and engage with men and women in the industry. Special thanks to the International Cotton Association for giving us this platform to deliver the podcasts, as always. And thank you, Imar, for today.
Thank you, Cam, and thanks for listening, everyone. Bye.